Chapter 15. After an hour, Belisarius finally found what he was looking for. It had been a thoroughly frustrating hour. On the one hand, he had found plenty of lone soldiers, but all of them had been common Malwa troops, shirking their duty by hiding in alleys and out-of-the-way nooks and crannies of the city. None of these men had been big enough for their uniforms to fit him, nor for that matter did he think he could pass himself off as an Indian from the Gangetic Plain. Yetai was what he wanted. The Yetai in the West were often called White Huns. The word white actually was misleading. The Yetai were not white in the sense that Goths or Franks were. The complexion of Yetai was not really much different than that of any other Asian steppe dwellers. But their facial features were much closer to the Western norm than were those of Huns proper, or for that matter Kushans. And since Belisarius himself was dark-complected for a Thracian, as dark as an Armenian, he thought he could pass himself off as a Yetai well enough, especially since he could speak the language fluently. Yetai tended to be big, too. He was quite sure he could find one whose size matched his own. Yetai he found aplenty. Big Yetai as well. But the Yetai always traveled in squads, and they tended to be much more alert than common troops. Fortunately for him, the alertness of the Yetai was directed inward rather than outward. Toward the common soldiers they were rounding up and driving into the streets. Scouring the streets and alleys was beneath the dignity of Yetai. That was dog work for common troops. Their job was to whip the dogs. At first, as he watched the massive search operation which began unfolding in the capital, Belisarius was concerned that he would be spotted before he could make his escape from Kaushambi. But soon enough, his fears ebbed. After half an hour, in fact, a half hour spent darting from one alley to another, heading west by a circuitous route, Belisarius decided that the whole situation was almost comical. The explosion of the armory had roused every soldier in the Malwa capital, of every type and variety. And since there were a huge number of troops stationed in Kaushambi, the streets of the city were soon thronged with a mass of soldiers. But the soldiers were utterly confused and largely leaderless. Leaderless not from lack of officers, but because the officers themselves had little notion what exactly they were supposed to do. But they didn't want to seem to be doing nothing, especially under the hard eyes of Yetai, so the officers sent their men scurrying about aimlessly. Soon enough, the masses of troops charging and countercharging about the city had become so hopelessly intermingled that any semblance of disciplined formation vanished. Watching the scene, Belisarius realized that he was witnessing one of the military weaknesses of the Malwa Empire. The Malwa, because of their social and political structure, had no real elite shock troops. The Malwa Kshatriya, who had a monopoly of the gunpowder weapons, functioned more as privileged artillery units than elite soldiers. The Yetai, for all their martial prowess, were not really an elite corps either. Their position in the Malwa army was essentially that of security battalions overseeing the common troops rather than a spearhead. And the Rajputs, or Kushans, who could easily have served the Malwa as elite troops, were too distrusted. The end result was that the Malwa had no body of soldiers equivalent to his own Thracian Bucellarii. And for the task of hunting down a foreign fugitive in the streets of a great city like Kaushambi, especially at night in pouring rain, a relatively small body of disciplined, seasoned men would have done much better than the hordes of common troops whom the Malwa had sent floundering into action. So, with relatively little difficulty, Belisarius managed to get almost to the outskirts of Kaushambi within that first hour. Three times during the course of his journey, he encountered platoons of Malwa soldiers. Each time he handled the situation by the simple expedient of commanding them to search a different alley. The Malwa troops, hearing authoritative words from an authoritative figure, never thought to question his right to issue the orders. True, they didn't recognize his uniform, but between the darkness and the rainstorm, it was hard to make out the details of uniforms anyway. Every soldier in the streets of Kaushambi that night looked more like a half-drowned rat than anything else. And besides, the Malwa Empire was a gigantic conglomeration of subject nations and peoples. No doubt the man was an officer of some kind. His Hindi was fluent, better than that of the soldiers in two of those platoons, in fact. and only an officer would conduct himself in that arrogant, overbearing manner. Malwar troops had long since been hammered into obedience, and they reacted to Belisarius like well-trained nails. Then, finally, he found his lone Yetai. Hiding in some shrubbery near the mouth of an alley, Belisarius watched a squad of Yetai hounding a mob of soldiers down one of the large streets, which formed a perimeter for the outskirts of Kaushambi. As they passed the alley, one of the barbarians split off from his comrades and stepped into it. Belisarius drew back further into the shadows until, watching the man, he realized that his moment had arrived. The Yetai was big enough at least, and best of all, he was about to provide Belisarius with the perfect opportunity. The Yetai moved 10 feet into the alley, turned to face one of the mud-brick hovels which formed the alley's walls, and began preparing to urinate. The operation took a bit of time, since the Yetai had to unlace his armor as well as undo his breeches. Belisarius waited until the Yetai finally began to urinate. Then he lunged out of the shrubbery and drove the barbarian face first into the wall of the hovel. The Yetai, stunned, bounced back from the wall. Belisarius hammered his fist into the man's kidney once, twice, thrice. Moaning, the Yetai fell to his knees. Belisarius drew his knife, cut the strap holding the barbarian's helmet, cuffed the helmet aside. Then, dropping his knife, he seized the Yetai by his hair and slammed his skull into the wall. Once, twice, thrice. Quickly he glanced at the alley mouth. Belisarius gave silent thanks again for the darkness and the monsoon downpour. The Yetai's comrades had heard and seen nothing. After returning the knife to its sheath and placing the helmet on his own head, Belisarius hoisted the unconscious barbarian over his shoulder and moved quickly back down the alley. 30 yards down, well out of sight, he set the man down and began stripping his uniform. Within 5 minutes, the barbarian was as naked as the day he was born, and Belisarius was the perfect image of a Yetai. Now he hesitated, facing a quandary. The quandary was not whether to kill the Yetai. That was no quandary at all. As soon as he removed the barbarian's clothing, and thereby any danger of leaving telltale bloodstains, Belisarius drew his knife. He plunged the sharp little blade into the back of the man's neck and, with surgical precision, severed the spinal cord. The quandary was what to do with the body. Belisarius dragged it to the side of the alley and began stuffing it under some shrubbery. He wasn't happy with that solution, since the body would surely be found soon after daybreak, but he stopped, examining the mud-brick wall. It was not, he suddenly realized, the wall of a house. It was a wall sealing off one of the tiny backyard garden plots with which most of Kaushambi's poor supplemented their wretched diet. He glanced around, gauging the area. He was in one of the many slums of the city. Decision came instantly. He hoisted the body over his head and sent it sprawling across the wall. A split second after he heard the body's wet thump in the yard on the other side, he sent his own Roman uniform after it. Then he began striding down the alley, marching with the open, arrogant bearing of a Yetai. He was taking a gamble, but he thought the odds favored him. He was quite sure that the residents of that humble little house, shack, say better, had heard the commotion. By the time he reached the end of the alley, they would probably already be examining the grisly and most unwelcome addition to their garden. What would they do? Alert the authorities? Possibly. In a rich neighborhood, they would certainly do so. But in this neighborhood, he thought not. Poor people in most lands, certainly in Malwa, India, knew quite well that the authorities were given to quick solutions to unwelcome problems. Found a dead man in your own backyard? Why'd you kill him, you stinking swine? Robbed him, didn't you? You deny it? Ha! We'll beat the truth out of you. No, Belisarius thought that by sunrise the Yetai's body would have disappeared along with the Roman uniform. The uniform, cut up, could serve a poor household in any number of ways. The body? Fertilizer for the garden. He wished that unknown family a good crop and went on his way. The three cataphracts thundered down the road leading due south from Kaushambi. Valentinian was in the lead, followed by Anastasius, with Menander bringing up the rear. The young cataphract was more terrified than he'd ever been in his life. "Slow down, Valentinian, damn you, slow down!" It was no use. The driving rain hammered his shouts into the mud. At least the mud might keep us from breaking our necks after we spill the horses, thought Menander sourly. Valentinian was setting an insane pace. He was driving his horse at a full gallop down an unknown road in pitch dark into a rain coming down so heavily it was impossible even to keep one's eyes open for more than a few seconds at a time. Oh, yes, and without stirrups. Yet somehow they survived, without spilling the horses or falling off their saddles. They were past the guardhouse before they even saw it. By the time they managed to rein in the horses and turn them around, the Ethiopians were already there.
"Are you mad?" demanded Garmat.
Valentinian shrugged.
"We were short of time."
He pointed with his face toward the guardhouse.
"Are they taken care of?"
"Be serious," growled Wasi. "We got here half an hour ago."
Aeon, Azana, and Cadphises brought up the extra horses.
"We'd better switch mounts," said Anastasius. "We've pretty well winded these."
"Winded me, too," grumbled Menander. "Valentinian, you're fucking crazy."
The veteran's grin was as sharp and narrow as a weasel's.
"You survived, didn't you? We're cataphracts, boy. Cavalrymen."
As the cataphracts switched to new horses, Wasi stated very forcefully,
"We are not cavalrymen, so let us maintain a rational pace."
"Won't matter," said Cadphises. "We're cutting into the forest a half mile down. We'll have to walk our horses through that trail, if you can call it a trail."
"You do know where we're going, I hope," said Valentinian.
The Kushan's grin was every bit as feral as Valentinian's.
"I will not tell you how to ride a horse. Do not tell me how to find a trail."
He was as good as his word. 5 minutes later, the party of 8 men and 20 horses turned off the road and entered into the forest. At first, Menander was relieved. As Cadphises had said, it was impossible to move down that trail at any pace faster than a horse could walk. Walk slowly. Menander had thought it was too dark to see before. Now he was essentially blind. The thick, overhanging branches, combined with the overcast night sky, turned the forest into a good imitation of a leafy underground mine, without lanterns. The only good thing, as far as he could tell, was that the tree canopy was so dense that it sheltered them, more or less, from the downpour. Menander wasn't worried about falling off his horse. They were moving at the pace of an elderly woman. Nor, after a time, was he concerned that the horse might trip. The trail, though narrow, didn't seem to be littered with obstacles. He was simply worried that they would get lost, and, in addition, that they were making such poor time that their Malwa pursuers would catch up with them, even with the tremendous head start that Valentinian's insane ride had given them. But when he stated those concerns to the broad back of Anastasius ahead of him, the veteran was unconcerned.
"First, lad, don't worry about getting lost. The Kushan seems to know his way. Don't ask me how, I can't see a damn thing either, but he does. And as for the other, be serious. When the Malwa get to the guardhouse and find the dead guards, they'll assume we continued on the road south. They'll never spot this little trail to the side. They'll charge right past it and keep going."
"We didn't cover our tracks."
Anastasius laughed scornfully.
"What tracks?" he demanded. "This downpour? This fucking Noah's flood will wash away any tracks in less than a minute."
Menander was still unconvinced, but he fell silent. And then, half an hour later, when they finally emerged from the forest, admitted that his fears had been foolish. Admitted at least to himself. He said nothing to Anastasius, and ignored with dignity the veteran's dimly seen smile of vindication. Once they emerged from the forest, they found themselves on another dirt road. Mud road, rather. They reversed directions completely now and headed north. After a mile, perhaps less, the road curved and began heading due west. Menander's fears resurfaced. New ones. He seemed to have a Pandora's box of them that night.
"Does Cadphises know where the hell we're going?"
The rain had eased off considerably. Enough that Menander's words carried forward. Cadphises' reply came immediately. The prologue to that reply was quick, curt and very obscene. Thereafter, relenting, the Kushan deigned to explain. This road does not connect to the other until a small town 50 miles to the south, nor does it go to Kaushambi. It circles two sides of a swamp to our left, and from here we'll go due west for more than 20 miles. Before then, however, we will have turned south again on yet another road. By now the Malwa will have no idea where we are, and best of all, this road is not guarded. It is a peasant's road only, not a merchant's route. Where will we meet Husanas and the other Kushans? Asked Aeon. Kadphaisi's shrug could barely be seen in the darkness. That is up to them, Prince. Kujalo knows what road we're taking. If he can find your hunter, or your hunter finds him, they will track us down, if your hunter is as good as you claim. Aeon's only reply was a grunt of satisfaction. In the event, Usanas didn't have to track them down. Shortly after daybreak, many miles down the new road heading south, they came upon Usanas. The hunter, along with Kujalo and the three other Kushans, were waiting for them by the side of the road. Fast asleep, even reasonably dry under the semi-shelter of a long-abandoned hut, except for one Kushan standing guard. Valentinian was exceedingly disgruntled, especially after he spotted the basket of food with very little food left in it. "You had time to eat, too?" he demanded crossly, climbing down from his horse. Usanas sat up, stretched his arms, grinned.
"Great cavalrymen move very slow," he announced. "I be shocked."
"Shocked?
All illusions vanished."
Kujalo smiled.
"You should be traveling with this one. Really, you should. He was already waiting for us when we made our break from the army camp. How the hell he got there so fast from the river, I'll never know. Especially with two baskets of food."
"Two baskets?" whined Valentinian.
"We save one for you," said another of the Kushans, chuckling. "Usanas insisted. He said if we didn't, Anastasius would never argue philosophy with him again."
"Certainly wouldn't," agreed the giant. "Except for simple precepts from Democritus. All matter can be reduced to atoms, including Usanas."
The cataphracts and the Ethiopians tore into the food. After their initial hunger was sated, Menander's youthful curiosity arose.
"What is this stuff?" he asked.
"Some of it is dried fish," replied Kujalo. "The rest is something else."
Menander, thinking it over, decided that he would leave it at that. The stuff didn't actually taste that bad, after all, even if he suspected the rest had once had far too many legs to suit a proper Thracian. By the time the food was gone, the rain had finally stopped. Kujalo and another Kushan went into the woods and brought out their horses.
"Where'd you get the horses?" asked Valentinian.
Kujalo pointed to Usanas.
"He had them. Don't ask me where he got them, because I have no idea. I'm afraid to ask."
Valentinian shared no such fear.
"Where'd you get them?" he demanded again.
Then, watching the ease with which Usanas swung up into his saddle, complained,
"I thought you didn't like horses."
"I detest the creatures," replied Usanas cheerfully. "Horses, on the other hand, are very fond of me."
The hunter led off to the south, called over his shoulder.
"This shows excellent judgment by both parties, don't you think?"
Somehow in the hours that followed, as the band of soldiers canted their way toward the far distant Deccan, Menander wasn't surprised to discover that Usanas was as good a horseman as he'd ever seen. At daybreak that same day, the captain of the Bengali detachment, which guarded, so to speak, huddled about would be more accurate, the Lion Gate of Kaushambi, waved a casual farewell to the nobleman and his retinue. After the last of the noblemen's escort and their women camp followers had paraded past down the eastern road to Pataliputra, he ordered the gate shut.
"Fine man," he said approvingly. "Wish all those Malwa snots were like him."
"How much?" asked his lieutenant.
The commander didn't dissemble. His lieutenant was also his younger brother. Most of his detachment, in fact, was related to him. He extended his hand, palm open. His brother's eyes widened.
"Send for our wives," commanded the captain. "Today we will feast."
That same moment, Belisarius stalked through the Panther Gate, one of the western gates of Kaushambi. The gate was poorly named, in truth. Small and ramshackle as it was, the Alleycat Gate would have been a more suitable cognomen. But of course, that was why he had picked it. On the way through, he terrorized another Malwa soldier. The man scuttled frantically away from the barbarian's threatening fist. He had no desire to end up like his sergeant, sprawled senseless on the ground. Once he was through the gate, Belisarius turned, planted his fists on his hips, and bellowed, "Next time, you dogs, when a Yetai tells you to open the gate, do so without argument." He drew his sword. "Next time I'll use this." He thrust the sword back in the scabbard, turned, and marched away. Behind him he heard the gate screeching loudly. The hinges hadn't been greased properly, and the Malwat troops were in a great hurry to close it. A tearing great hurry. The road Belisarius was taking was one of the newly refurbished roads which the Malwa had been constructing. This was no muddy peasant path. The road was 15 feet wide, raised above the plain, properly levied, and paved with stone. It was a road even Romans would have been proud to call their own. The road ran parallel to the north bank of the Jamuna River, a few miles to the south. The road led west by northwest until it reached the city of Mathura, some 300 miles away. Belisarius had no intention of traveling as far as Mathura, however. Just north of Gwalior, the Chambal River branched to the southwest. About 100 miles up the Chambal, in turn, the Banas River branched directly west. There were roads paralleling those rivers which would take them all the way to the ancient city of Ajmer, at the very northern tip of the Aravalli Mountains. Ajmer, he mused. From there I can either go south or west. But I wonder. Again, he summoned aid to his assistance. Aid had already provided him with all the geographic information he needed. Now, tell me about the royal couriers. The rain had finally stopped. As he strode along openly right down the middle of the road, Belisarius continued the discussion with aid until he reached his conclusions. Thereafter, he simply admired the dawn. "Might even get a rainbow," he thought cheerfully.